Hello, and welcome to An Englishman in the Balkans. I'm David Bailey, and over the past nearly 12 years, this podcast has taken on many forms, from interviews and audio diaries to cultural snapshots and expat reflections. You might notice some different podcast names mentioned along the way, but it's all part of the same journey, one that explores life, people, and stories from this fascinating region I now call home. If you're enjoying the listen, I'd love it if you left a quick review or rating wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps others discover the show. And if something in the episode sparks your interest or curiosity, why not drop me a message? I always enjoy hearing from listeners. I always reply.
You're listening to An Englishman in the Balkans.
Welcome to An Englishman in the Balkans podcast with me, David Pacinovich Bailey. In this podcast, you'll get a unique look at life in Bosnia and Herzegovina through my eyes, the eyes of an immigrant. Each episode, I share my experiences living in this often misunderstood country and introduce you to some of the interesting people I've met along the way. From exploring the rich culture and history to discussing the challenges and joys of immigrating to a new country, this podcast offers a thoughtful and engaging look at life in the Western Balkans.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you would like to support us and the production of future episodes, then please consider maybe giving us a tip or becoming a member of our podcast family. The link to do that is in the show notes for this podcast. Thanks again for listening. We really do appreciate it.
You're listening to An Englishman in the Balkans.
Welcome to An Englishman in the Balkans, the podcast that takes you on a captivating journey into the heart of Bosnia and Herzegovina and the wider Western Balkans. Each episode, we delve into the rich history, vibrant culture, and hidden gems of this beautiful country. Through engaging conversations and personal anecdotes, we aim to bridge the gap between the Balkans and the rest of the world. So sit back, relax, and get ready to be inspired, entertained, and connected.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you would like to support us and the production of future episodes, then please consider maybe giving us a tip or becoming a member of our podcast family. The link to do that is in the show notes for this podcast. Thanks again for listening. We really do appreciate it.
It's An Englishman in the Balkans podcast. And today, it's a bit weird because I'm sat in Bosnia and Herzegovina. I'm not in the country of my birth. And the person I'm talking to is sat in the United States of America. I'm not in the country of her birth, but the person that we're talking to in this particular episode has got an amazing story to tell. And I'll start like this. A couple of weeks ago, I found out about an amazing book that is in Sarajevo. It's called the Sarajevo Haganah. I didn't realize that it's one of the oldest Jewish books in the world, which has suffered so much, and is in Sarajevo. And then I find out that the Jewish prayer for Passover, the chant when they say that prayer, the melody was taken by the Ladino people and turned into a Ladino song, which in turn turned into one of the most popular Evda songs from Bosnia and Herzegovina. And I remember a few days sitting down saying, wow, two things to do with the Jewish people in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And then, out of left field, comes a new film. It's from 2023, which involves a relationship between a Jewish family and a Muslim family in Bosnia and Herzegovina. Based on a true story, I saw the film this morning. I'll be open and honest with you, I got very emotional about it. And we're going to find out more about it. The director of the film is Sabina Vajvacher, did I say that correctly? Who I think is a very special person, notwithstanding the fact that when we had a chat before we started this recording, she said, where are you? And I told her, and she said, that's my hometown. So I'm like outside where she lived, and it's so cool. We start every podcast with this standard question, because the only person that can really answer it is the person themselves. So I'm going to ask this. Who is Sabina Fajracha?
That's a very philosophical question. That's a nice way to start this conversation. Who is Sabina? I was born in Banja Luka, as we discussed, and came to the United States as a war refugee in 1994, and have been an artist since birth. I decided when I was about 8 years old that I wanted to be a film director. That's about the age that I found out that such a position exists. My dad was a cinephile. I grew up watching a lot of movies with him, very age inappropriate, meaning like we watched The Godfather when I was seven. And so grew up loving movies. And then when I found out that there was a position that actually there's a job that somebody makes it, I said, okay, I want to be that. And my family is full of very practical people who did art as a hobby, but not as a profession. So everyone just patted me on the head and said, good for you, and you're going to grow out of it. And I never grew out of it. I just pursued it. And even through all the upheavals that we lived through, the war and immigration to America and struggle and everything, it was the one thing that I held on to and the one dream that got me through all of it. And I now live in Los Angeles, California, and make movies, write and direct, and I couldn't be happier. Does that answer your question a little bit?
Yeah, I think so, because I was going to ask you, could you share a little bit about your journey into the actuality of filmmaking? Because it's something that I think it's a very tight industry. And a very competitive industry.
Yeah, you can say that. And then some. I live in Los Angeles, and everyone goes, oh, yeah, of course you live there, and it's so nice. But the journey to get here and journey still to this day is extremely difficult. And this country, the United States is an enormous country to begin with. And then in terms of film, I would say there's a lot of nepotism, of course, a lot of people who grew up in this industry and already have a leg up. And then on top of that, up until very recently, I would argue that still is, it was very male driven, and specifically straight white male driven. And so to try and make it in this and break in as a woman who is not from this country, who also came into a country that didn't really have a Bosnian American community before we showed up. So there was no community to welcome us and help us and give us a leg up. And my dad couldn't call anyone and say, hey, we went to college together and now your cousin is the head of some studio. Can you please hire my daughter as her first entry level job? There was nothing like that. So once I decided when I was eight and then just follow that path. But maybe because I'm a born optimist, and some people would say naive in my belief that anything is possible if you just put your mind to it. My dad would say I'm just stubborn, but I just keep going. It's taken me a really long time. I've been on this path for a very long time, and I just keep making one film after another. And how I make these movies, I put them on my credit card. I apply for grants. Sometimes I get them. A lot of times I ask people for favors and we just make movies for basically nothing, but I just kept making them. And how I specifically got into film, I was a theater director first. When the war happened and we had to flee. When the Serb forces came in, our family was targeted almost immediately. And I ended up in Croatia as a refugee. On my own, I was 14 at the time. I was with extended family, but I was pretty much on my own and for about a year. And during that year, Croatia at the time was very, let's put it this way, it wasn't very Bosnian or Muslim friendly. They didn't want us there and they were very clear about it. And so in order for me to really survive, especially since I didn't have a support network or even a family around me that protected me, I had to basically erase my identity. I pretended that I was a full-blooded Croatian, that Muslim Bosnian, that wasn't part of my identity. And then I stumbled across a theater company. And there was a theater company in which I went to see a show, and in the crew, they had some Bosnian names. And I thought, oh my God, this, I could actually, like, the Bosnians can get jobs here, and what are they doing, you know? And then I desperately wanted to be part of that theater company because I felt like that could be the one place where I could be myself and I could just listen, tell the world that I listen to the music I listen to and speak with an accent that I was born with versus the accent that I adopted to. And I started a theater magazine because I was a writer all my life for the 6 years that I was writing. And I talked some friends that I met in high school to start a theater magazine with me. And we did. And that got me a job at that theater company. And then suddenly I was amongst, quote unquote, my people, my family. I felt like they all just embraced me for who I was. And I didn't have to pretend. And in that way, it saved my life. It was a very formative time of my life. I was a teenager trying to figure out who I was. And I was living in a place where I wasn't allowed to do that. I had to pretend to be somebody I wasn't in order to survive. So suddenly I was in this cocoon of people who just said, be whoever you are. You can say whatever you want and we still love and embrace you. And that made me, I fell in love with theater for that reason alone. And so when my mom finally managed to escape Bosnia and join me in Croatia about a year later, she saw for how the country was at the time and said, we can't stay here. You're never going to have a future here. And so she started figuring out where else we could go. Denmark and Sweden had already closed their borders by then, so did Germany. And so she said, okay, United States just open up their borders. Let's go there. And so herself, me, and my younger brother immigrated to the States as refugees, ended up in Florida. My father was still, he spent the whole war in Banja Luka trying to save people and run this underground operation and humanitarian effort to save as many people as possible. And we ended up in the United States, and I very proudly announced that I wanted to now be a theater director. That's what I wanted to be. And because I felt theater saved my life, and I wanted to dedicate my life to theater. And my mom, I always tell this story because I think it's really important, because so many parents who have children who want to pursue artistic pursuits try to talk them out of it because it's not a practical pursuit. You want to do theater, especially in a country like United States. It's crazy. You study for 4 years and there's no guarantee of a job. And even when you get a job, you're going to get paid so little that it's really just a glorified hobby. And you better be a trust fund baby or marry rich, because otherwise it's very hard to survive. And yet, even though we were here as refugees, we had nothing to our name. Like I said, we had no community to lean on. We were just struggling. And I was a straight A student. And my mom could have said, hey, I really need you to become a doctor or a lawyer or a finance executive, like somebody that makes money, because we need that help. We don't have anything. She said, no, we came here for you and your brother to pursue your dreams. And if that's what you want to be, I support you. You go for it. And so I went and I studied theater directing as my undergrad, graduated and moved to New York, because that's where you go when you do theater, and did theater for about 5 or 6 years. And then in that time, the war ended. My father survived by sheer miracle and joined us in United States. And in 2003 or 2004, we were contacted by the Bosnian government saying, the property you were forced to leave when you fled for your lives, you can now come back and reclaim. And I was neck deep in the theater. Like, I was doing this off-Broadway production and really in that world. And so I thought, oh, that could be interesting. I was also in complete denial about what happened. My PTSD was completely untreated. I, like all the other Bosnian Americans, just turned another leaf and said, okay, that never happened. Let's just forget about it. And kept going forward and becoming very American. And the play I was doing was about ancient Greek mythology. But I thought, okay, maybe I can, there was just something, because the play was about the intersection of beauty and violence. And I thought, okay, it could be interesting to go and record some stuff in Bosnia because maybe I can use it in this play. That was the initial idea, that I would go with my parents when they go to reclaim this property that we're being given back by the government and record something for this play. And then as I started talking to everybody and my collaborators in this production, as well as my parents, I started realizing there is much more to the story. And the thing is that once my father came to America, he never told me what he did. We never talked about it. It was just this keep going forward. And then suddenly he started opening up and telling me about the story, what happened in Bosnia after I left, what happened in that part of Bosnia and what he did for 3 years that I didn't see him. And by the time we landed in Bosnia, it was clear that it was going to be a documentary film. And so we've shot and made my first film was a documentary called Back to Bosnia. And it was, but it's so interesting how it wasn't until the film was already finished and I'm in a festival circuit and I'm going and I'm doing a Q&A at one of the festivals. And it hits me afterwards. I was like, oh, wait, this is what I wanted to do when I was a little 8-year-old girl in Bosnia. Here I am. I have found my way back to it in a very circumstantial way. Like I didn't really think that it was going to happen. And here I was. And it still took me a couple of years to really fully embrace that I was switching from theater to film. That was a transition that my younger self really wanted all along. So I eventually said, okay, I'm going to focus on film now. And like I said, didn't really have any connections or money or anything, but I had all these actors that I worked with in theater. And so I would write little short scripts. And then on a weekend, from the money that I made in my office job, I would just get this group of actors together and say, okay, I'll buy everybody pizza and coffee and let's make a movie. And I was learning that way to actually tell stories in that way through narrative and camera work and all this stuff. And I kept doing that and meeting, and I volunteered on film sets and production companies to learn how actually it's done, because at the time I was like, I can't afford film school, so this is how I'm going to do it. And did that for a number of years. And then one of my mentors that I met through those freelance jobs and volunteer positions said, I think you really need to go to film school. And I said, I can't afford it. And why would I go to film school? Like, I just made all these movies. I know how to make movies. And he said, you need connections. You're a refugee. You're a woman. This industry is tough enough for the rest of us, but for you, it's even tougher. So you need to go make some connections, meet some people who can open doors, and talked me into coming to USC. And so I got my master's in film directing from University of Southern California in Los Angeles, and then just stayed. And I've been slowly, very slowly pushing my way into the industry and hoping that I'll make a difference in some way.
I know very little about filmmaking, but I think the two main parts of it maybe are the cinematographers and the directors, the main storytellers. Would that be right?
Yes, I think that's what the public usually sees. I would add producers in that. People usually don't know what producers do, but a producer is basically a person who puts it all together and who makes sure that you have all the ducks in a row, that you have all the players that can actually make a production, and who sees the director's vision and then actually physically executes it. I think that's a position. So that's why when a film wins a best film at the Oscars, it's the producers who get that, not the directors, because the producers produced the actual film that you're seeing. The director is the visionary behind it. It's a person who, like you said, in a visual aspect, yes, directors and cinematographers, their work is visible on screen. But a producer is a behind-the-scenes person who makes it happen, because without them, it wouldn't be possible. And I would also say production designer. I had one of my cinematographers, directors of photography I worked with for the longest time. She said to me once, when we first started working, she said, I can be as amazing of a cinematographer as you want me to be. I can light perfectly. I can find great angles. But if I'm shooting a white wall, it's going to look like crap. So if you're going to spend money on something, spend money on a good production designer so they can make sure that wall has something interesting to look at. or at least it's a different color, so it looks more cinematic. And I always remember that. And so I put a lot of money and effort into production design so that my cinematographers have something to film.
Because the director is it's your eyes that people look through, right?
It is. So you can think of a director as everyone understands drawing or painting, right? We have more concept of that. So you put an object and you have all these people in a room who are going to paint it. The director is a person who's going to interpret that object in their own way. The way that I would paint that is going to be very different than you would paint that or anyone else. And the same way that you look at Picasso and you say, okay, Picasso painted a nude in a very different way than people before or after him. It's the same thing that what a director does with a script and how they bring it to life.
Now, you found this story, which has turned into this wonderful film called Sevap Mitzvah, which I believe, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, is good deed?
Yes, I think that's the closest English translation of it. Sevap, in Bosnia, what we mean by that is it is a good deed, but it's a deed that you do for the benefit of everybody, for the benefit of others, without expecting any reciprocity. It's like a kindness in the shadows when they have those memes or things on Facebook and Instagram where it's like, oh, so-and-so was just really kind to a person without anyone paying attention to it, and then they're discovered. So it's like that. The sevap is something you do just because you believe it's going to benefit us as a humanity or world at large without wanting any recognition or reciprocity for it. And I felt for this particular story that was very appropriate because I find that what Zeynep Hadaga did was just like that. She just did it for the benefit of the world at large or what she believed in her heart was a good thing to do.
The story is, as I said, based on true events during the Second World War in occupied Bosnia and in fact in Sarajevo, right? And it's a very powerful film. I said earlier on that I got emotional about it. But it's about a Muslim woman who risks her livelihood to save her Jewish friends. And 50 years later, as you said, that reciprocity comes back because she helps her. Two-part question. Where did you find out about the story? And for me, that was getting emotional. Was it emotional for you during the production and the direction process of the film?
I found the story really through research. I wanted to tell a story about Muslims and Jews coexisting happily in Bosnia because I've lived in the United States for now most of my life. And the narrative here is that Muslims and Jews hate one another and they've always hated one another. And there is no example they could ever possibly love one another. And it's just this narrative that is constantly propagated so that to the point that even when I have a lot of Jewish friends and I'll go to parties with them and somebody will make some sort of a smart remark about, oh, isn't it funny? Muslim and a Jew walk into a party. And there's always this joking. And in Bosnia, we say every joke is half true. So what people are joking about something they actually believe. And that really bothered me. I find that to me, what's really fascinating about those two particular cultures is how similar they are. And in my experience in the United States, people I had the most in common with were my Jewish friends, which is why I have a lot of them as friends. We ate very similar foods and our customs were very similar. And even the overbearing family that was constantly getting in your business, that's very Bosnian, as is very Jewish, as I've discovered here. And so I wanted to tell this story because of that narrative, because I'm very sensitive to the stories that we consume on a daily basis, that media feeds us and movies and even conversations that we have. I think that's what really shapes our perception of the world. And I'm very much interested in how us as filmmakers, as storytellers, can help shape a different perspective for people, something that is more kind, more full of love, more interconnected. How can I, as a storyteller, help the world that watches my movies experience the world around them in a more integrated way. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to tell a story about Muslims saving Jews in World War II, because I've heard about those stories from my grandmother, my late grandmother. And I started researching, and then I came across that black and white photo that you see at the end of the film, and the caption said, Zainab Hadaga is walking down the Nazi-occupied, the street in Nazi-occupied Sarajevo in 1941, hiding the Star of David armband that Rivka Kabido, her friend, underneath her burqa. And I thought, wow, that is fascinating. What is this about? And so I started reading up about it some more. And once I found out the entire story, I don't know, it struck me as the one that I really wanted to tell. I didn't want to tell an imaginary story. I didn't want to make something up, because I feel like then a lot of people could just be like, oh, Sabina, you and your idealism, good for you. You think that people coexist and love one another. So I decided to tell that particular story. And was it emotional? Yes, it was absolutely emotional. It was emotional to me when I was writing it, because like you put on this very pragmatic hat, right? I write my first draft, and then I'm working and doing rewrites, and then it's very technical line of a dialogue and how I'm going to shift from here to here. Like I'm trying to tell a story, and then it's not until you finish it and then you can just read it in one sitting that emotions can come back in, that the heart is engaged again. And I remember when and then of course, when I'm filming, I'm very much again in that pragmatic thing. I'm like, okay, I need to have this scene. I need to have this moment. I know. So it wasn't until my editor and I put it all together and were watching the picture lock version of the film. And it ended. This is before music, before sound design, before anything. We just cut the film and watched it. And it ended. And both he and I had tears in our eyes. And I thought, okay, after months and year, at that point, over a year of me with the story and knowing exactly what's going to happen. And I'm the one who shot that movie. And I knew that I could still get emotional. I felt, okay, then this is going to hit home for a lot of people. Or at least I hope so. So I'm very happy to hear that it did with you.
There's a scene where the two brothers are discussing how things will play out. One brother saying, you're going to get us killed. And the other brother asserts himself and drinks his coffee. And I have to say, I actually have been in that room, not the physical house or the physical set, but the way the dialogue was, for anybody from Bosnia and Herzegovina and this region would see it, they've lived that in one way or another. You said it was a memorable moment with tears in your eyes. I have to admit now that I had tears in my eyes as well. But what memorable moment from the film do you have where you have more of a smile on your face?
Yes, there is one moment that it actually didn't, because it was a moment that happened before we had the cameras rolling, so I didn't have it on film, let's say. But so it's when the Ustasha soldier stops Zainaba and Yosef and the kids at night and is questioning them. And there are these two little kids. They're just kids. One is the daughter of my production designer. The other one is just the kid that someone, because I needed kids. And so I said, okay, I need kids that look like my protagonist who has children that are willing to come and be in the movie. And so I had this little boy and little girl. A girl is 4, boy is 5. And we're rehearsing before we were to film we were going to do their coverage on the two of them when this Ustasha soldiers kneels down and talks to them to try and get them to reveal that they're Jewish. And of course, the little kids, they see everybody's friendly. And the guy who's playing Ustasha is a really nice guy. So they're just like, oh, smiling and not really getting that this is a dangerous moment. And so I leaned down to talk to them and I said, I explained to them that this is a dangerous situation in a very child-friendly way. And I say, and he's a scary man. And the little boy, they just met each other, these two kids, earlier that day. And the little boy looks at me and then looks at the little girl who is playing his sister and then hugs her and goes to protect her against this bad man, the way he saw it. And my heart just burst open. I just thought, wow, here's exactly what we're trying to, I'm getting emotional now. Here's exactly what this film is about. It's about that instinct that we have in us that we, I think as humans, as children, it's obvious, we have an instinct to save one another, to help one another. And that's what I was trying to tell with this film. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what our religion, our ethnicity, our skin color, or any of the other labels that we are forced to group people in once we grow up. None of that matters if we can still remember that humanity in us, that little boy hugging this girl that he just met because he really believed that this man is now a bad guy and could do some harm to this little girl. I don't know. To me, that it was an incredible moment. And I was so sad that we didn't get it on camera because, of course, then when we filmed it, he played out what he did. But that moment of him hugging her to protect her was just incredible.
Yeah, but the face that she made when she looks up was absolutely, yeah, that was, that punched. That really did. Sabina, your road to Tzevach Mitzvah has not been an easy one. It's work. We've won some awards. And I've got to ask you, how do you now handle the pressure and the expectations that come with directing a film that's been nominated for an Academy Award?
Thank you for that question. It is very stressful and a lot of expectations, and a lot of people are bombarding me with their own needs when it comes to this particular part of the journey. And I have to say, I came across meditation and philosophy about 13 years ago now, and I've been a daily meditator for about 11 years. And that helps tremendously because it grounds me in the fact that all of that stuff is amazing and I'm so grateful. And it is ultimately what, in terms of my career, I'm working towards. But at the same time, it's very, I'm trying to stay in that healthy place and not let my ego run amok and cause troubles. And it helps me relegating other people's egos and expectations. But it's very stressful. They started voting today. The voters are voting for the next 4 days between today and Monday on the first round of the Oscar for the shorts, meaning that out of 190 films, they're going to narrow down to top 15. And then they're going to vote again to narrow down to the five that actually go to the Oscars. And then you find out which one won at the big ceremony. And I woke up fully aware that people are now watching it with that in mind and nervous that we're not going to make the cut and optimistic that we will. And so it's a lot of very mixed emotions. But like I said, thank whoever, universe, gods, put me on a path of meditation because it really helps tremendously.
You mentioned earlier on about in the Balkan mentality, and I see this every day, young people have these dreams, but their parents say, no, you've got to be a doctor, you've got to be a lawyer. And it really frustrates me because I've got my own kids and that never came into my head, right? So you've driven your own path on your own road, and you have a lot of experience. What advice would you give to aspiring filmmakers from Bosnia-Herzegovina who could be watching or listening to this, who hope to follow in your footsteps?
I would say make sure you have the stamina for it, in both in terms of how long it might take you to actually, quote unquote, make it, to make a film that gets noticed, that makes a difference. You might luck out and it's your first film. Great. I would love that for you. And at the same time, you might be like me. Tzevach Mitzvah is the 19th project that I directed, whether it was film or commercial or feature film, short film or feature film or documentary. So 19th. I made 19 things before one of them is now in the race for the Oscars. Was it all worth it? Absolutely. I think it made me a much better and a stronger director. I have a much clearer idea of who I am and what I want to say. And I think that's obvious in this film. Did I believe that I could do this when I was 22 and starting out? Absolutely. If you asked me then, I would have said, yeah, I can make an Oscar-winning film. And maybe I would have been right. I think talent is something we're all born with. I think that if you hear the call of the arts, specifically film, like if you feel in your heart of hearts that this is the path for you, you need to figure out how to keep at it. And stamina is one. The other thing is to not listen to people around you. Like my dad said, I'm stubborn. He told me, he didn't actually say this to me. He said it to a friend of my parents. We were all at the dinner party together and they were commenting on how I just keep going like an Energizer bunny. And my dad said, I've spent most of her life since she decided to be a film director trying to convince her that this isn't the path for her. Trying to tell her, my dad's an economist. And it's not because he doesn't love me. It's because he loves me. He's scared for my future. He sees how hard it is for me. He sees that I've struggled both emotionally and financially and had made such enormous sacrifices in order to stay on this path. And he doesn't want that for me. He wants me to be married with kids and lots of money and a house in Malibu and five Oscars on my shelf. That's what he wants to see for me. And every year that goes by and that isn't happening, he panics. And so in that panic and out of love for me, he just goes, oh, what about this job? And what about this? And you're so smart. You could also this. And he said, I've been doing this to her for about 20 years and she has not bat an eyelash. She just keeps ignoring me and doing it. So he says, so if she survived that coming from me, then anybody in Hollywood, any executive telling her no is not going to make a difference. And he's right. And I think that as supportive as my parents have been, and as much as they love me, and as I said, my mom just said, keep pursuing your dream. I'm right behind you. And eventually got my dad to sign up for the same thing. All that to say is that if you have parents who don't want you to pursue this path, it is normal. It is more than normal. I think 99% of parents do not want their kids to take a path that is so hard and strenuous with no guarantee of anything as filmmaking is. But if you've heard the call, the way I say it, nothing in life is going to make you as happy as pursuing this. Nothing. I've tried getting off this path and it never worked. So just try it, keep at it, and maybe you'll luck out and it won't take 19 films. Maybe it'll take just two. And you'll make it to where I am.
I know that you're nervous today. I started counting, right? And I think that advice you just gave was first class. However, if you could go back in time and give yourself one piece of advice before starting the production of Sevak Mitzvah, what would it be?
Lower your expectations. I would give that advice. I think when I wrote the script and set out to make it, everyone around me was like saying, oh, this is going to get into all the festivals. It's going to win all the awards. And I made the film and we sent it to festivals and it didn't get into any major festivals. And it took about 6 months of festival submissions before it started making any, like we were started getting into festivals. And even the festivals that got into it, it got into some really fantastic festivals, but they're not majors, right? They didn't get into Toronto or Cannes or Sundance or Tribeca or any of these major things. And so a lot of people then around me said, oh, you give it a try. You just let it go and move on and go and do another project. And I didn't, because like I said, I keep going and I believe in my heart that every project that I do, I have to get it all the way to the end. And only when all the doors have been closed and there is nothing left for me to even try and open, do I say, okay, thank you very much. I'm going to move on to the next project. So I would say lower your expectations, because it's very easy to get caught up in people around you who love you and who see the talent that you have and even the beauty of the story you're trying to tell, and the hard work you're putting in, and they're just filling your head with these ideas of greatness. And if you let that become the dominant narrative in your head, you might end up getting severely disappointed. And I think, again, I was, when we didn't get into any of those festivals, I was very disappointed. And I had to constantly remind myself that I believe in this film. I believe in this story. I think this is a story that the audience is going to love whenever they eventually do see it. And so that's what kind of keeps you going.
We're at the end of the road, because now it's just up to voters to work out who's going to be in those envelopes for that lady or gentleman to open on the night, right? But let's look at something more realistic as my final question. When you started, you knew what the story was, how you wanted to tell the story, how you wanted to stimulate emotionally, et cetera. What lessons do you want audiences to take away from watching Sebat Mitzvah?
The biggest lesson and the biggest message of this film is that, underneath all those labels that we put upon one another and groups that our communities and our politicians and our elders put us in, we are all human. And we need to remember that. It is something that I wholeheartedly believe in. My parents instilled that in me. And even after everything that we lived through in Bosnia, I still divide people only in two categories. And that is if they're good or if they're bad. And we all know what that means. But what it means to me is if in their heart they have love and they function from that place and they remember that humanity. They remember that it doesn't matter that a person next door to you is of a different religion, different ethnicity, different race, different sexual orientation, different political party. If that person is a good person, you remember to do good for them and to them, and they will do the same to you. And there are people who have greed and hatred in their heart, and it doesn't matter. That they just see everybody, including the members of their own quote-unquote group, as enemies, and they will do everything just for self-centered reasons. And so I really want the audiences who see this film, who are moved by it, because I believe that people who are moved by this film are those people who come in the first category, the people who are good, who recognize that goodness on screen because they have that goodness in them, to remember that, to carry them on in their day-to-day life, so that if they see any sort of injustice that stirs their heartstrings and they can do something about it, that they do something about it when they see it, regardless if the injustice is being done to the member of, quote-unquote, their group or some other group. Because the groupation and tribalism and otherism is what gets us into wars and into trouble and into hatred. And we need to find ways to overcome that. And I really hope that this film about two women who are very ordinary, who had no power on the surface and still risk their lives to save one another, even though they weren't the members of the same group. And in some parts of the world, they're members of the warring tribes. If they could do it, then we can do it too.
Sabina, thank you so, so much for giving me your time today. I know you're very busy and I know that your nerves must be going like this. What is keeping you occupied at the moment, apart from the thought of what are they saying? Have you got your new plans in place already?
Yeah, the biggest one is I want to turn this into a feature film. I wanted to from the beginning, and I am now, I mean, it's hard. I think for the next 4 days, I'm just going to be trying to distract myself so that I'm not freaking out in my apartment. But I've started writing the feature script for this. And so that's, as far as a writer, that is my current project. And I have a couple of feature films that my reps and producers are trying to find financing for. And one, it's been my passion project for, at this point, 5 years. This is how long it takes, guys. If you want to be a filmmaker, like I said, stamina. It's the kind of conversation that it's like every Christmas vacation that I go to visit my parents in Florida and meet their friends, they're always like, what are you working on? I'm like, oh, it's still the same project that was last year. And but it's a feature film that's set in a Bosnian community in Florida. And it's about the first generation of immigrants, us who came, the refugees, but the children who came. We came as kids, and then 20-some years later, the different paths that transition put us on and how we navigated that. And it's a neo-noir crime thriller about two brothers on two different paths in this particular world. And it's something I'm really passionate about, and I hope that maybe once we win the Oscar, the financing institutions and people and gods are going to finally say, okay, here's the money you need to make this film, and I can finally make it. So keep your fingers crossed, everybody. I really appreciate it.
And that's a wrap for this podcast. We hope you've enjoyed finding out a little more about both Bosnia and Herzegovina and the wider Western Balkans. If you've enjoyed this journey as much as we enjoy bringing it to you, please take a moment to leave us a review and subscribe to our podcast. Your feedback helps us tremendously and makes a huge difference. Thank you once again for joining us, and we'll see you on the next episode.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you would like to support us and the production of future episodes, then please consider maybe giving us a tip or becoming a member of our podcast family. The link to do that is in the show notes for this podcast. Thanks again for listening. We really do appreciate it.
You're listening to An Englishman in the Balkans.
Welcome to An Englishman in the Balkans podcast with me, David Pacinovic Bailey. In this podcast, you'll get a unique look at life in Bosnia and Herzegovina through my eyes, the eyes of an immigrant. Each episode, I share my experiences living in this often misunderstood country, and introduce you to some of the interesting people I've met along the way. From exploring the rich culture and history to discussing the challenges and joys of immigrating to a new country, this podcast offers a thoughtful and engaging look at life in the Western Balkans. So that's it for this one. Thanks for keeping me company. If you enjoyed the episode, maybe share it with a friend who might like it too. And if you've got thoughts, questions, or just want to say hello, you can always reach out. Also, if you'd like to support the podcast and help me keep telling these stories, you can drop a little tip via Buy Me a Coffee. The link is in the show notes. Even a euro or two makes a big difference. So that's it then. Take care, and I'll catch you in the next episode.